2 Samuel 3-4, the second talk in a series in 2 Samuel, was presented by David Crabtree on February 15, 2009, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed, in whole, for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I hope the mic's working. This will be a bad day to not have a mic. I woke up at 5 this morning with a bad sore throat, and as you may be able to tell, my voice is a little distorted this morning. So I will do my best, and as we go along, maybe Dick can crank it up a little more, and we'll see if we can't do this. 2 Samuel, chapters 3 through 4. In the first two chapters of Samuel, we have a civil war that first two chapters of 2 Samuel, we have a civil war that breaks out between the forces of Saul's son Ishbosheth, who has been installed as king of Israel as a whole, and the forces of David, who has been installed as king in Hebron over Judah, over just the tribe of Judah. The civil war lasts for about 7.5 years. Apparently, the fighting is the most sharp in the last 2 years. It isn't until the last 2 years that Ishbosheth is declared king in Israel. The commander of the forces for Ishbosheth is Abner. He had been a commander under Saul and continued to be the commander under Ishbosheth, and was apparently the force behind the throne. He's really the power broker in Israel. The main commander for David is Joab. Joab is a relative of David. He's a cousin. He has been with David from the very beginning. He and his two brothers, Abishai and Asahel. Asahel, however, was killed. He's dead by this time. He had been killed by Abner. So Joab has been with David all along, and he is the commander of David's forces. He's David's right-hand man. 2 Samuel chapter 3, verse 5 verses. Now there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. And David grew steadily stronger, but the house of Saul grew weaker continually. Sons were born to David at Hebron. His firstborn was Amnon by Ahinoam the Jezreelitess, and his second, Chileab, by Abigail, the widow of Nabal the Carmelite, and the third, Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur, and the fourth, Adonijah, the son of Haggith, and the fifth, Shephatiah, the son of Abital, and the sixth, Ithream, by David's wife Eglah. These were born to David at Hebron. So the first section just summarizes the fact that the civil war has been going on. It was a lengthy conflict, and as we saw hints of, a very bitter conflict that caused a lot of animosity one side to the other, as civil wars are prone to do. But through the course of this conflict, there is a trend. That trend is David and his forces are gaining in strength, while Ishbosheth and his forces are diminishing. During this time, David, while living at Hebron, has a number of sons. We only have sons recorded. We only have sons recorded. We don't know how many daughters there were. The important thing is how many potential heirs to the throne are there? And David has several. He has a son born to him by Ahinoam. Ahinoam was the first wife that we learn of after Micah. His very first wife is Micah, the daughter of Saul. But after David left, Saul gave Michal to another man, and we'll run into that in just a little bit. His second wife was Ahinoam, and he had a son by Ahinoam whose name was Amnon, and he will show up later in the narrative in 2 Samuel. His third wife was Abigail, if you'll recall, just a few chapters in 1 Samuel. Abigail was the wife of Nabal, and if you'll remember, there was that incident where Nabal was very stingy. Abigail tried to mediate in the situation and give stuff to David's men, stuff that really they deserve to have, food. Then Nabal died as a punishment of God for his stinginess. And David married Abigail right then. So that was his third wife, the second wife that's with him. Those are the wives that went with him into Philistia. By Abigail, he had a son, Chileab, who I don't believe reoccurs in the narrative. I think this is his only mention. Then his third son, by his fourth wife, Maakah. Maakah was the daughter of Talmai, the king of Geshur. Geshur is a part of Bashan. So Bashan is in the other side of, on the other side of the Jordan, in the northern part. That was the area that I think was given to the half-tribe of Manasseh. And the half-tribe of Manasseh was not able to drive out the inhabitants of that area. Remember, God told them that they were to drive out the inhabitants and to occupy the land. In that area, the Manassehites were not able to drive all of them out, and Geshur is one of those groups of people that they were not able to drive out. That son, the son that's born to Maakah is Absalom. He will show up in the narrative later on. The fourth son to the fifth wife, is Haggith, and that son is Adonijah. He also will show up in the narrative later on. The fifth son born to the sixth wife, Abital, is Shephathiah. That would be a tough name to give to your son. And there's no further mention of him in the text. Then the sixth son, born to the seventh wife, Ithream, born to Eglah. There is no further mention of either one of those. David is multiplying wives. He's got quite a number here. Something that was very common at the time, that kings would establish friendships with other kingdoms by marrying daughters of those kings, or marrying into the royal family of the other kingdom. So it was very common for kings to use marriage as a tool of foreign policy. And it appears as though David is doing the same thing. So he has quite a number of wives. Next section. And it came about, while there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David, that Abner was making himself strong in the house of Saul. Now Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. And Ishbosheth said to Abner, "Why have you gone into my father's concubine?" Then Abner was very angry over the words of Ishbosheth and said, "Am I a dog's head that belongs to Judah? Today I show kindness to the house of Saul, your father, to his brothers, and to his friends, and have not delivered you into the hands of David. And yet today you charge me with a guilt concerning the woman. May God do so to Abner and more also, if, as the Lord has sworn to David, I do not accomplish this for him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and to establish the throne of David over Israel and over Judah, from Dan even to Beersheba. And he could no longer answer Abner a word because he was afraid of him. Okay, we've got an incident in the house of Ishbosheth that is a significant development. Abner is the power behind the throne. If it were not for Abner, Ishbosheth would not be king at all. Abner probably has engineered this from the very beginning, since right after Saul died. Abner was probably working on pulling together Israel and trying to consolidate power once again after Saul has died. And the person who really needs to be in that position, because of custom, is the son of Saul. And the only son of Saul remaining is Ishbosheth. He's probably not the right man for the job, but he becomes a figurehead that Abner uses, and Abner provides the real power behind the throne. Saul had had a concubine. I don't know how many wives Saul had, but this is a concubine in addition to the wives that he had. Her name is Rizpah, and she has a couple of children, a couple of sons, that are going to show up later in the narrative. So we will come back to her. But this is just one of Saul's wives and concubines. And the charge is from Ishbosheth that Abner has had sexual relations with a concubine of the dead king Saul. Now, that is not... That is an act that is full of meaning. In the ancient world, to have sex with a wife or a concubine of a king is a rebellious act. That's making a claim to the power, the authority of the throne. That's what one does when one is trying to demonstrate the weakness of the existing king and claim to be the power that deserves to replace the king that's there. So the charge that is being made here is essentially treason. And that's the way he responds to it, is he defends his loyalty. So that's clearly what's at stake here. The question is, Ishbosheth is suspicious that Abner is not loyal to him, not loyal to the throne. Abner's response is, am I a dog's head that belongs to Judah? In other words, am I a traitor? Am I a scoundrel that's been bought off by Judah? Am I a turncoat that's working for the other side? And then he says, today I show kindness to the house of Saul, your father, to his brothers, to his friends, and have not delivered you into the hands of David. He's stressing that up to this at very moment, I have continually been loyal. And yet, right now, in this time that I have still been loyal to you, you are making this accusation. So Abner gets really mad and swears that, and I think the assumption is, if you are going to assume that I've been disloyal, I will do the very thing that you fear. I will turn power over to David. And he says an interesting thing. He says, transfer the kingdom. Let's see. He says, may God do so to Abner and more also, if as the Lord has sworn to David, I do not accomplish this for him. So Abner knows that David, that God has sworn to David the throne of Israel. And he's acknowledging that here. And he's saying, if you're going to assume that I have been disloyal, I will do the thing that you're afraid of. And that thing is the thing that God has preordained. I will turn power over to David and Judah. And the implication is, he's got the power to do it. He can do this. He can carry out this threat. Ishbosheth is obviously frightened by this threat and knows that this is a very potent threat. And it says he could no longer answer Abner a word because he was afraid of him. So Ishbosheth has been scared to death. So Ishbosheth is not going to confront Abner anymore. And Abner has been made mad. Next section. Then Abner sent messengers to David in his place, saying, "Whose is the land? Make your covenant with me, and behold, my hand shall be with you to bring all Israel over to you." And he said, "Good, I will make a covenant with you, but I demand one thing of you, namely, you shall not see my face unless you first bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see me." So David sent messengers to Ishbosheth, Saul's son, saying, "Give me my wife Michal, to whom I was betrothed for 100 foreskins of the Philistines." And Ishbosheth sent and took her from her husband, from Paltiel, the son of Laish. But her husband went with her, weeping as he went, and followed her as far as Bahurim. Then Abner said to him, "Go, return." So he returned. So Abner decides to carry through with his threat. He's going to turn power over to David. He decides to do it sooner rather than later. And so he sends messengers to David. He wants to have negotiations, a negotiated settlement to the civil war that leaves the king out of it. And he says, "Make your covenant with me." So don't make it with Ishbosheth. Make your covenant with me. Make an agreement with me. I have the power to be able to turn it over to you. And David welcomes this opportunity. This looks promising to him. And he's willing to make an agreement with Abner, but he wants to make sure that Abner has the power to deliver the goods. He wants to make sure that Abner can do what Abner has said that he would do. So David sets up a test to see what kind of power Abner has within Israel. He wants his wife back. If you will recall, he got Michal originally because Saul had told him that if he were to kill, I think it was 200 Philistines and bring back their foreskins, that he would give his daughter to David in marriage. Saul was thinking he will die in the attempt, that this is a good way to get rid of David. But David accomplished the task. And so Saul carried through with his promise and married Michal to David. But when Saul turned against David and was seeking opportunities to kill David, and David fled from Israel, Saul took his daughter Michal and married her to someone else, to Paltiel. So now David wants Abner to show his strength by asking Abner to deliver Michal back to him. And David's perspective is, I have a right to her. We were rightfully married, and I earned her doing what I was asked to do. So there's no reason that she should not be returned to me. But there's also a political motive, and that is, David is not descended from Saul. David has no claim to the throne by direct descent. But he is married to the daughter of the king, Saul. And if that can be restored, then he has a claim to the throne by marriage. And I think that's what he's trying to accomplish. So David sends a messengers to Ishbosheth, saying, "Give me my wife, Michal." So the agreement is not that Abner can just go kidnap Michal and return her. David wants this done officially, legitimately. So he sends messengers not to Abner, but to Ishbosheth to return Michal. So he wants this through official channels. This is nothing clandestine. He wants this all in the open. Ishbosheth obviously doesn't feel like he can stand up to Abner, and he capitulates, allows Abner to take Michal and return her to David. And we have this scene, which is one of the saddest scenes in the Old Testament, as far as I'm concerned, where the one to whom Michal had been given, Paltiel, is following along because Michal is being taken away from him, and there are political forces at play to which he's no match. There's no way that he can stand up to the political powers that are in play. He is just a victim of these larger geopolitical forces. And so he follows behind weeping, and at some point Abner just turns to him and says, "Go back." Which he does. Next section. Now Abner had consultation with the elders of Israel, saying, "In times past you were seeking for David to be king over you. Now then, do it. For the Lord has spoken of David, saying, 'By the hand of my servant David I will save my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines and from the hand of all their enemies.' And Abner also spoke in the hearing of Benjamin. And in addition, Abner went to speak in the hearing of David in Hebron all that seemed good to Israel and to the whole house of Benjamin. Then Abner and 20 men with him came to David at Hebron, and David made a feast for Abner and the men who were with him. And Abner said to David, 'Let me arise and go and gather all Israel to my lord the king, that they may make a covenant with you, and that you may be king over all that your soul desires.' So David sent Abner away, and he went in peace." So Abner delivers Michal to David. He proves that he's got the power to be able to deliver the goods, that he's in a position to be able to negotiate in good faith. And then Abner begins to consult with the elders of Israel. So now he's talking to the leaders of each tribe of Israel other than Judah. Judah has separated itself out and is under the control of David. And it's interesting what they say, what Abner says. He says, "In times past, you were seeking for David to be king over you. Now then, do it. For the Lord has spoken of David, saying, 'By the hand of my servant David, I will save my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines and from the hand of all their enemies.'" Apparently, there has been sentiment voiced in the past by the elders of Israel that they should be under David's authority. And Abner is recognizing this. But apparently in the past, Abner has resisted that. Now Abner has come around. Abner sees that as a good thing and wants to deliver power over to David. It says that he also spoke in the hearing of Benjamin. That's important because Saul was from the tribe of Benjamin. If there are going to be any that will resist this move, it's going to be the tribe of Benjamin. So he speaks especially to them. Then Abner, after having spoken to the elders of all the tribes of the north, he goes to David and tells him everything that these elders have said to him. They begin the negotiations for a settlement that will bring power of all of Israel under David's control. The big event then is Abner coming down for a visit to David, and he comes with 20 men. They come and have a big feast. to finalize this agreement that will pass power to David. And they apparently come to an agreement. This is going to happen. And David sends Abner away, and he goes in peace. So it's a done deal. They've sealed the deal. This is interesting. If you're thinking about David's psychology, this is what a long series of events has been leading to. He must have been elated. It has now come to pass what had been prophesied and what David has also been working hard to gain, and that is his power over all of Israel, unified. But then we see the next section. And behold, the servants of David and Joab came from a raid and brought much spoil with them. But Abner was not with David in Hebron, for he had sent him away, and he had gone in peace. When Joab and all the army that was with him arrived, they told Joab, saying, "Abner, the son of Ner, came to the king, and he has sent him away, and he has gone in peace." Then Joab came to the king and said, "What have you done? Behold, Abner came to you. Why then have you sent him away, and he is already gone? You know Abner, the son of Ner, that he came to deceive you, and to learn of your going out and coming in, and to find out all you are doing." So Joab comes back with a number of David's men. They've been out raiding. That's what David's men have been doing for many years now. Comes back with a lot of spoil. So he's feeling successful. He's feeling like he's accomplished much. He comes back, and what does he find out? He finds out that Abner has been right there in Hebron. Joab doesn't much care for Abner. If you'll recall, Asahel, who is Joab's brother, in one of the conflicts during the Civil War, had been running, chasing after Abner to kill him. And Abner didn't want Asahel to kill him, strangely enough. And on a couple of occasions, turned back and said, "Go kill somebody else. I don't want to have to kill you. So turn aside. Go someplace else." And Asahel said, "No, I want you." And Asahel kept chasing him, and Asahel was fast. So Abner ends up turning on Asahel and running him through with a spear and killing him. Joab could not forgive Abner for having done that. Joab wants Abner dead. So when Joab hears that Abner was right there in Hebron and could have been taken captive and could have been put to death, but instead David comes to some negotiated peace settlement and sends him away in peace, Joab is outraged. And Abner's thinking is, Joab's thinking is, Abner was just a spy anyway. He wasn't here in good faith. He was just here to spy and take information back that he will use to come back at us with. So Joab is outraged. And he informs David of how much he's outraged. He can't believe that David has done such a stupid thing. Next section. When Joab came out from David, he sent messengers after Abner, and they brought him back from the well of Sirah, but David did not know it. So when Abner returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside into the middle of the gate to speak with him privately, and there he struck him in the belly so that he died on account of the blood of Asahel, his brother. And afterward, when David heard it, he said, "I and my kingdom are innocent before the Lord forever of the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. May it fall on the head of Joab and on all his father's house. And may there not fail from the house of Joab one who has a discharge or who has a leper or who is a leper, or who takes hold of a distaff, which I think it means a crutch, or who falls by the sword, or who lacks bread. So Joab and Abishai, his brother, killed Abner because he had put their brother Asahel to death in the battle at Gibeon. So Joab acts independently. Joab decides that he's going to take matters into his own hands. David has made a huge blunder. Joab is not going to let that plague them. He sees this as still an opportunity to kill Abner. So he sends messengers to Abner who call him back. And once he gets back, Joab takes Abner aside and stabs him in the stomach, runs him through as he had done to Asahel. And he dies. David is outraged. And so David proclaims a curse on Joab and his descendants. Actually, it's on the... may it fall on the head of Joab and all his father's house. So it extends to Joab's brothers as well. And the curse is that may there be these calamities, these troubles that follow the house of Joab's father throughout. May they constantly be plagued with these troubles, because the guilt of the death of Abner ought not fall on David, it ought not fall on the kingdom, it ought fall on those who are responsible for this evil doing, and that is Joab and his brother. You notice in verse 30 that so Joab and Abishai, his brother, killed Abner. So Abishai was also involved in this plot. Joab is obviously the leading force, but Abishai is also implicated in the plot. Next section. Then David said to Joab and to all the people who were with him, "Tear your clothes and gird on sackcloth and lament before Abner." And King David walked behind the bier. Thus they buried Abner in Hebron. And the king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner, and all the people wept. And the king chanted a lament for Abner and said, "Should Abner die as a fool dies? Your hands were not bound, nor your feet put in fetters. As one falls before the wicked, you have fallen." And all the people wept again over him. Then all the people came to persuade David to eat bread while it was still day. But David vowed, saying, "May the Lord do so to me and more also if I taste bread or anything else before the sun goes down." Now all the people took note of it, and it pleased them, just as everything the king did pleased all the people. So all the people and all Israel understood that day that it had not been the will of the king to put Abner the son of Ner to death. Then the king said to his servants, "Do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel? And I am weak today, though anointed king. And these men, the sons of Zeruiah, are too difficult for me. May the Lord repay the evildoer according to his evil." So David realizes, he understands very well, that when you have a bitter civil war, it is very difficult to bring that to a conclusion. Because in a civil war, especially a bitter civil war, there will always be a large number of grievances that people want revenge for. And that goes on in an endless cycle. And it's very difficult to tell people, "We're stopping now. Whatever scores are unsettled will remain unsettled." People don't like that. So it's very difficult to bring these kinds of civil conflicts to a halt. David understands that. And what Joab has done has been to just get that started again, get that whole cycle going again. And so everything that David has worked towards could potentially disappear. It could all evaporate away. So David wants to be very careful here. He tells Joab and the people that were with him, "You're going to lament the death of this man that you killed." They're supposed to tear their clothes and gird on sackcloths and lament before Abner. And David himself also laments the death of Abner. He goes behind the bier, walking behind the bier. Abner is buried at Hebron in a place, apparently a place of honor. And David weeps and mourns over Abner's grave. And then David proclaims a psalm that he has apparently written for this occasion. And in this psalm, he says, should Abner die as a fool dies? Should he die as an innocent man at the hands of wicked men? He says, your hands were not bound, nor your feet put in fetters. So you weren't taken captive. This was a sneak attack. And you fell as one falls before the wicked. And clearly he's laying the blame on Joab and his conspirators. So everybody wept the death of Abner, including David. And I think David's weeping, we are to understand that this is sincere. It's not just an act. I think David has a lot of respect for Abner, as he has had a lot of respect for Saul and others as well, I think. The people come to David. They're worried because he hasn't been eating, and they insist that he eat. And David is determined to not eat. He's not going to eat until the sun goes down as a sign of his true condolences over the death of Abner. And because of the way David has behaved, the people of Judah, and I think probably it's also true, the people of Israel, it says, so all the people and all Israel understood that day that it had not been the will of the king to put Abner, the son of Ner, to death. So people see David's actions as they are intended, and that is, David is truly sorry that this has happened. And David's comments are very gracious. He says, a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel. And he points out that there is weakness with respect to him. He cannot deal with Joab and his men as he ought. And we'll talk about that a little bit more later. So he asked God then to bring vengeance on Joab. A couple of things in this section that I want to note before we go on to chapter 5. The first is that in verse 31, that is the first time that David is referred to as King David in the narrative section. So this seems to be the point in time at which David takes his position as king of all Israel. He isn't technically king of all Israel yet, but from the narrator's perspective, this is the moment at which it really happens. He begins to act as the king of all Israel. The other thing I want to talk about is the narrative does not say definitely that Abner was not guilty of the rebellious act. So did he do it or did he not do it? And I think that's a fairly significant question with respect to the narrative. It's possible that he had done it, that he was pulling some kind of coup. The narrative would allow that. But I think if we look at the narrative as a whole, that's not the case, that Abner is depicted as one who is noble. David certainly relates to Abner as one who is a noble man, someone who keeps his word. And so I think that we are to see him as a noble man. And also when Asahel was chasing him down, I think it's significant that Abner really didn't want to kill Asahel. And I think we're supposed to take that into account. Abner is really basically, I think, a good guy. That's significant because we can kind of reconstruct what's happening in Abner's head. Abner had been a loyal commander to Saul all the way through the conflict with David. And Abner had been there and had seen Saul's reactions to David. And if you will recall, there was a point in time when David snuck into the camp of Saul at night, and he stole Saul's spear and jug of water as proof that he could have killed Saul if he had wanted to. Then he snuck out. And the next day, as you will recall, who did he speak to first? It was to Abner and the men. I think David was trying to make his case to Abner directly at that point in time, trying to make sure that they understood that David was not a traitor. And there must have been some reason that David thought that that might take. Well, Abner had been with Saul throughout that period of time. Well, now Ishbosheth is saying, Abner, you are rebellious against me. You're a traitor. Well, Abner must be seeing deja vu all over again, that now Abner understands the position that David had been in with respect to Saul. David had been accused of being a traitor, and there was nothing that David could do to convince Saul that he had not been a traitor. And now Saul's son Ishbosheth is telling Abner, you're a traitor. And Abner's thinking, this is the same thing. Ishbosheth is doing the same to me that Saul had done to David. And Abner's saying, this isn't going to work. I'm taking action. So I think that's the way we're supposed to interpret these, what Abner is doing here. Okay, chapter 4. Now when Ishbosheth, Saul's son, heard that Abner had died in Hebron, he lost courage, and all Israel was disturbed. And Saul's son had two men who were commanders of bands. The name of the one was Baana, and the name of the other Rechab, the sons of Ramon, the Berathite of the sons of Benjamin. For Berath is also considered part of Benjamin. And the Berathites fled to Gittaim, and have been aliens there until this day. So Ishbosheth, he hears what's happened to Abner, he's scared to death. Because although Abner, there had been a rift between Abner and Ishbosheth, as far as he knew, Abner had not acted on his threat. And Ishbosheth absolutely has to have Abner's power behind him in order for him to stay in his position. So Ishbosheth is obviously scared to death. And as happens in such cases, all of Israel is kind of uneasy. What is going to happen? Who is really in power? How is this going to play out? And it's at times like these that bold men decide to take their chances and make a move, make a power grab. And that's exactly what's going to happen here. The two that are going to make the power grab are the two commanders, Baana and Rechab. And we'll come back to those in just a second. Next section. Now Jonathan, Saul's son, had a son crippled in his feet. He was 5 years old when the report of Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel. And his nurse took him up and fled. And it happened that in her hurry to flee, he fell and became lame, and his name was Mephibosheth. So Jonathan, who was Saul's son, with whom David had made a covenant, a promise to be loyal one to the other all life long, and to their descendants. Jonathan's had a son, Mephibosheth. And on the day that Saul and Jonathan were killed in the battles, where this happened 7.5 years ago, this son was 5 years old. The nurse picks him up to flee. There's probably chaos when they hear word of this. And I don't know whether the chaos is because they don't know who is going to take power here or whether they're afraid of the Philistines. It's not really clear, but there's panic. The nurse picks up the son of Jonathan, runs out, but she falls, and in the fall, probably breaks Mephibosheth's leg, and it never does grow back normally. So he is always lame. There's a curious thing to stick in here, because this should have been put in several chapters ago, like three chapters ago. My experience is whenever you see a section in the Old Testament that's way out of place, there's some reason for it. And I'm not sure exactly what the reason for this is. But it is interesting. We've got Ishbosheth, who is the only remaining son of Saul. And that's who this chapter is about, really. And then we have the only remaining son of Jonathan. And I think that we are to compare the two. I think that's why Mephibosheth is mentioned here. Ishbosheth is going to suffer a brutal death. Mephibosheth is going to enjoy the privileges of having the promise that David had made with Jonathan and Jonathan had made with David fulfilled. David is going to go way out of his way to make sure that Mephibosheth is treated with honor for his entire life. So I think we're seeing the contrast of the fates of Saul, and Saul in his faithlessness, and his descendants are going to suffer an evil fate, as opposed to Jonathan and his loyalty to David and the promises that they had made with each other. His descendants are going to enjoy those promises. Next section. So the sons of Rimmon, the Berethite, and Rechab and Baanah departed and came to the house of Ishbosheth in the heat of the day while he was taking his midday rest. And they came to the middle of the house as if to get wheat, and they struck him in the belly. And Rechab and Baanah, his brother, escaped. Now when they came into the house, as he was lying on his bed in his bedroom, they struck him and killed him and beheaded him. And they took his head and traveled by way of the Arabah all night. Then they brought the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron and said to the king, "Behold, the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy, who sought your life. Thus the Lord has given my lord, the king, vengeance this day on Saul and his descendants." So these two commanders in midday when it's hottest and the king's taking his siesta, they pretend to be coming into the palace in order to get some food and take a detour. They go into the room where the king is sleeping and they run him through and kill him. And not only do they kill him, but they cut off his head, and then they are able to make their escape out and they take that head to David as proof that they have killed the son of David's enemy. Last section. And David answered Rechab and Baanah, his brother, sons of Rimmon and the Berethite, and said to him, "As the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from all distress, when one told me, saying, 'Behold, Saul is dead,' and thought he was bringing good news, I seized him and killed him in Ziklag, which was the reward I gave him for his news. How much more, when wicked men have killed a righteous man in his own house on his bed, shall I not now require his blood from your hand and destroy you from the earth?" Then David commanded the young men, and they killed them and cut off their hands and feet and hung them up beside the pool in Hebron. And they took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in the grave of Abner in Hebron. So they come thinking that they are going to get a reward from David for having killed the son of the man who had pursued him for so long and had tried to kill him for so long. And David's response was, "You haven't done your research very well." We've had one of these before, and I had killed the man who brought me the head of Saul. And in that case, it wasn't a treacherous death that was inflicted on Saul. In this case, it was a treacherous death. And as a result, you are even more deserving of death. So David commands that they be put to death. Both of them are killed. Their hands and their feet are cut off and put up on display. And the head of Ishbosheth is taken and given an honorable burial. So Ishbosheth is dead. The king of Israel is now completely gone. Abner had already made an agreement with David to restore the power of, to put the power of Israel under David's authority. So the unification of all of Israel under David has essentially happened, and then we'll see it's made official in the next chapter. There are a few things I'd just like to comment on briefly. I'll just point out, first of all, when David asked for Michal to be returned to him, that is done, and that is, I think, David's motivations for that were primarily political. That it was a way for him to test Abner's strength, but it was also a way for him to have a stronger claim to the throne. And Michal was indeed his lawful wife. So David wants things restored the way that they ought to be. But there's a sense in which it's kind of it's a sad situation. Michal was obviously loved by this man to whom Saul had given her when David was driven away. And now she is being returned to David to be one of what, seven wives? She'll be in a very different status now than she had before. And as we'll see, she's not particularly close to David. There's distance there. And as we'll see in later on in the narrative, she is going to become bitter over this experience, and that's going to play itself out in a couple of chapters. Another person in this narrative that I want to draw your attention to is Joab. He will show up a number of times throughout 2 Samuel and then into 1 Kings. He shows up a number of times. He outlives David, actually. But it's interesting that David is in a situation where he does not feel like he can punish Joab properly for the wickedness that Joab has done in killing Abner. I don't know exactly why not. Joab is his cousin. It could be family considerations are restraining. It's more likely to me that there are political considerations, that David just doesn't have the stability, the backing that would allow him to kill his very popular commander, Joab, and survive that. So for whatever reasons, David feels like he's not strong enough to take the action that would be appropriate with respect to Joab. Joab continues to live, continues to serve in a high-ranking position the rest of David's life. And Joab is a source of difficulty for Joab is a source of difficulty for David throughout David's reign. Joab is hard for David to keep controlled. Joab is a hothead. He carries a grudge. And that shows up frequently. And in fact, at the end of David's life, David, I think it's Solomon that David tells, "You're going to have to kill Joab." And Solomon does so. So Joab's a tough, a tough character for David to deal with, which is interesting. David's in a situation where he can't control somebody that's under his authority, but that's just the way it is. David asks God to take the vengeance that is appropriate here, and seems to give that over to God. Trust God to do that. And that brings me to the third comment I'd like to make, and that is, it is interesting to me here that David does a lot of things that are politic. The marrying a number of wives. Remember when he gave the gifts to the villages of Judah after he had defeated the Amalekites? He negotiates with Abner. He has his wife returned to him. I mean, there are a number of things that David is doing within the political realities in which he lives. And I find that very interesting, because David was just as much of a part of his context, and that context put real constraints on what he could do. He had to be a student of that context in order to know how to act. David is not a Puritan. He's not an ideologue. He's trying to do what's right, but he's also trying to act within the political realities of his time. That is an extremely difficult calculus. But that's the kind of calculus we all have to do. It's really tough. So he is politic, but he doesn't just do what is politically expedient. If he had just done what is politically expedient, he would have killed Saul a long time ago. So he doesn't just do what's politically expedient. He's trying to do what's right, but he's trying to accomplish the goals that he needs to accomplish while doing right, but within a political context where he has to act politically. And the last thing I'd like to point out is, it's interesting that David is very concerned about not just gaining control over all of Israel, but he wants to be the king of all of Israel. That is to say, he wants to act in the interests of Israel as a whole. And he wants the people of Israel to understand that that's what he is trying to do. So he is very forgiving and gracious with respect to his opponents, as opposed to a Joab who would act very differently. And he is able, because of that, to bring reconciliation in the wake of a civil war. And that is a difficult thing to do. We know that from history. That's a very difficult thing to do. And he is able to bring to a stop that cycle of violence and vengeance that so often comes in the wake of that kind of civil unrest. So David is a very interesting character, very complex and very real. It's someone I think that all of us can identify with. Okay, we have time for just a couple of questions probably.
Thanks, David. I really appreciate your last commentary there on David and just who he is as a person, because I think oftentimes he's lifted up as this ideal character in the Old Testament, the purest of the pure that we're to look to as an example of righteousness and someone who makes those calculus-type decisions. And in a way, he is, but he's been lifted to perfection, I think, in the eyes of some theologies, as a if you always just do what David would do in a certain circumstance, I guess I could ask a myriad of questions, but the first one that came to me earlier was, we do see David as someone who does strive to make righteous decisions. He holds the guys accountable who kill Ishbosheth. It is interesting that he doesn't deal with Joab, like you said, for whatever reason, but he does ask God to deal with Joab, mm-hmm. how Joab should be dealt with, which mm-hmm. is another way of doing it, I guess, mm-hmm. Especially if you're not sure. I was struck by how his men, their practice of gaining power for him was to go out raiding. Who were they raiding? And, I mean, are they just going out and pillaging? I'm assuming that they're not tribes of Israel peoples.
Right.
And are they justifying that because they're not tribes of Israel and this is the land that they were supposed to kick everybody out of, so it's okay to go kill all these people and take their stuff? I mean, this is righteous David, right? And he's sending his men out just killing people and taking their stuff.
Mm-hmm.
How does he justify that in his worldview of the time?
Well, I would assume that he would justify it just like you said, that I'm sure that they are not raiding Israelite villages. They're raiding either Canaanite villages or Philistine villages. And I assume that David would have justified it on the grounds that that's what God had asked the Israelites to do when they came into the land, that they were to drive out the inhabitants and they were to take possession of it. And I assume that David would say that we're doing what God had told us to do.
So there's a certain honor that exists within the bounds of all who would be sons of Israel, whereas, you know, David respects and honors Saul such that he never raises his hand to kill him,
mm-hmm.
but lets kind of, it seems that he lets God do his bidding. You know, he knows that it's God's will for him to be king, but yet he doesn't take it upon himself to force the issue.
Right.
And he does the same thing with Ishbosheth, or at least that was his intention, it seems
right.
like.
Right.
And oddly enough, Ishbosheth gets taken out of the picture
right.
in a way that David doesn't even condone, but yet it still happens, which
right.
is traditional practice, if I understand, when one, when two people are vying for a kingship, when the throne is taken by the one, the other's family are executed to a person.
That's pretty
extended
common.
Family and everything.
Right.
And there's a significance of Mephibosheth being spared of that.
Yes.
And I have some good theological stories from EBC on the significance of that, but
mm-hmm.
that's
mm-hmm.
another discussion.
Mm-hmm.
But David doesn't do those sorts of things. And I lost my train of thought.
Well, David is willing to take human life.
Right.
He has that done a number of times. So under certain circumstances, the taking of a human life is justified. What was different with respect to Saul and Ishbosheth is they were the anointed. Both of them had legitimacy that came from God. You don't just knock them off in order to claim the throne. That the throne had been promised to David, but David was convinced that that power would come to him legitimately when it was time to come. He wasn't going to act outside of the bounds of what righteousness called for him to accomplish that. That's what I find fascinating about this story is David is working hard to try to understand what are those boundaries on what I can and cannot do and be righteous and yet go for the goal, which is a goal that God has promised to me.
Right.
And it's a difficult process. And it takes a much longer time, I think, than David ever would have imagined. It's full of all kinds of frustrations along the way, ups and downs, and yet David kind of hangs in there and proceeds with his eye on the goal, but still trying to act within the bounds that have been given him. It's a fascinating problem that he's faced with, but it's the kind of problem we face all the time.
We seem to face those problems in the course of weeks and months, and
yeah.
he dealt with it over decades, it seems.
Right.
Like.
Well, we can face with those over decades as well. The biggest difference I see is God promised him a temporal endpoint. you are going to be king of Israel. I've never been given any temporal endpoint. So that's the biggest difference that I see. But otherwise, the struggle is the same.
Yeah. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, we better quit. I'm already over time. Thanks.